Welcome back. I hope, however, the time was spent, it had that had a quality of being nurturing and of benefit. And as I said before, we'll just move right into the sit. So I'm going to invite each of us to allow our bodies to come into a posture that allows us to feel upright and alert. And as I mentioned before, this might be in the sitting posture, it might be in the lying down posture, whatever is going to be supportive for the body. And it's the energetics of alertness, the energetics of availability. Can we collectively, as we take our seats together, establishing a commitment to stay available to the experience of this moment? In the next moment. For the anchor of our sit today, I want us to stay in the realm of mindfulness of the body, the first foundation of mindfulness. So often the instructions can be working with breath, an in-breath and an out-breath. And some folks might find that tremendously helpful as an anchor. I like the instructions, the invitation, sort of a half breath, allowing all of the attention to rest on a half breath in, or the inhale, which is a half breath, and then the attention on the exhale. I feel like this sets me up for success. It's not a big ask, although the mind can certainly wander, right? And this invitation to have an anchor, a home base, and we allow the awareness, invite the awareness, like stay here. And we know it will wander off, right? That's just built in. So we don't get upset about it. So the first invitation can just be resting the attention on the breath. And some of us may track the breath through the nose and inhale through the nostril and exhale through the mouth, inhale, exhale. It may be on the rising of the chest, falling of the chest. And sometimes I'll put my hand here just to really feel it. There's a deeper sense of embodiment if my hand's there. And I like with the belly too, the expansion of the belly, putting my hands there so I can just sort of ride along with the movement of the breath. Because the deeper invitation here is to allow the awareness to stay in the body. So an embodied awareness, an embodied awareness of an in-breath and an out-breath. For some of us, the breath is not neutral, whether we're sick or we have allergies or asthma or any number of reasons why the breath is not neutral. So just let that go. And we can use sensation, say the hands, are the hands holding each other? Are the hands resting on the legs as an anchor? Because invariably the temperature will change, the weight will change. The felt sense will change of whether the hands are holding each other or hands on the legs. And here we're, as with the breath, directing our attention. Hey, follow this, in breath, out breath. This is a similarly directed attention. Hey, check this out. We're going to rest the attention on the feeling of the hands resting on the legs, the hands holding each other, or wherever the hands are. That can be its own anchor. And this, again, an orientation, we are directing the attention. Hey, rest here. Knowing the mind will be like, I got something else to think about, or to perseverate about, or complain about, or be judgy about. Okay. And we build this in. We know this will happen. Okay. So part of the training that we undertake week after week is to survive that. Okay, mind will do what it does. And I can keep coming back to the sensation of an in-breath and out-breath, the sensation of the hands. Joseph Goldstein speaks beautifully of really slowing down to that point where we catch, oh, I've wandered off. Bring the attention back. And he's like, that's the experience of awakening. And it's a very dear experience. You're like, oh, this is what it feels like to come back to the body, to snap out of being lost in thought. So to really get excited and curious about those moments and not to be like, oh God, I wandered off again. Yeah, we know we're going to wander off. So how can we meet that enlightenment moment? We're like, oh, come back. Please remember there's no such thing as a bad sit. We come, we take our seats. The invitation to stay curious and gentle with ourselves. And we're directing the attention either to follow an in-breath, an out-breath, or the sensations of whatever the hands are doing. And ideally to keep them still. So we can just stay really curious about the progress and changes, however small they may be, in the sensation in our awareness. So enjoy our time that we have to sit together, even if the sit is hard. Yeah. So nice, as always, to sit together. And today, on this ninth day of March, I want to share together, talk together about, in some ways, sort of our relationship to the body, to the practice of mindfulness of the body, idea that there are 84,000 dharma gates, ways into practice, and the mindfulness of the body, there are also so many different ways of working with the body. And I name just, obviously just two, but the element practice that I bring in all the time, the working with the different body parts, 32 different body parts, and so on and so on. There's a lot of different ways. And in large part, because as I said earlier, it is said, the Buddha said that all of the teachings are in this body of ours. And on the, as the story goes, on the night of the Buddha's death, Ananda, his right-hand man, so to speak, and cousin and scribe, or not scribe so much, but he could retain his talks, had said, "Who, with you gone, who will be our best friend?" And the Buddha's reply is, "Your body. Your body will be your best friend." And I don't know about you, but that is not the message that I grew up with as a kid. As a Catholic, grew up in a very strict Catholic household. Like, the body was not good. All the urges of the body were bad. So it was not the messaging, the version I received, of the body is the best friend. And what it might be like to cultivate that as a way of being in the world, that this body of ours, it's really the only thing that stays with us from birth until death, is really the best companion we have, the only companion we have, and the best friend. And again, we are in at least the dominant culture that's like, oh no, let's go through all the different things that are wrong with your body. Too short, too tall, too thin, too fat, not this, not that, all like too old, too many wrinkles, too young. I mean, acne, all the different ways, particularly with women, that we're told, like, however you look, oh, it's not right, or it's not good enough. And it's many things. It's tragic. It's soul crushing. It's terrible. And it's a reality in the messaging starting early on that we receive. And as a child, and up through early adulthood, you know, the idea of my body is my best friend, I'd be like, what? No. Because there was such a disconnect in that quote that Jack Kornfield always used from, I think it's Ulysses, of Mr. Smith lived a short distance from his body. And that's how many of us live, just a little bit of a remove from this body of ours that is so sensitive and can feel so much that sometimes it's like, oh no, it's easier to be out. It's easier to dissociate. It's either easier to disconnect than to feel all that's going on in this body on an emotional level, but sometimes on a physical body, just the ways, and all of us have had various, I'm assuming, levels of trauma, capital T traumas and little T traumas that can impact the body. And it's painful, right? It can be really painful to stay connected to a body if there's an illness, again, trauma, illness, chronic, terminal, otherwise. And those of you know, the last couple of months I've been really struggling with a sensitivity I have to mold. I'm in Southern Florida. There's a lot of mold in Southern Florida, and really watching and allowing myself to really start to trust, like, this place looks fine. I know there's mold here. And getting the feedback of like, you're crazy, it's totally fine. Like, no, something in this system knows there's mold here. It's not, I can't be in the room, which was why I was outside for so many weeks. But this way of having almost to reclaim a trust in our body of something's not right. And it might be environmental, it might be in a relationship, it might just be that sense of something doesn't feel right. And my experience, and from those I've spoken with often in kind of a traditional Western practice, I mean, no disrespect to doctors who are out there, but there's women often, I'm speaking in generalizations here, oh, you're fine. You know, that intuition we may have of like, no, something's wrong. You're okay. It's a thing, and they're not always, but there can be and I'm again speaking in generalizations, a generalizing of diminishing women's pain. And I've read about it and heard anecdotally that this can be true, but all of this is saying that there are many different ways in which particularly women, because I know more about the women's experience than the men's, there are ways in which we are told, no, what you think is happening, no, women's intuition, really, we can go back through history, sort of the age of enlightenment, the shifting away from a nature-based way of relating to our bodies, to the earth. Those of us that grew up in homes that might have been somewhat traumatizing, but for myself, that the reality I thought was happening, people were like, no, it's not happening. And the crazy makingness of that. And what I found to be such a blessing in these teachings of, no, be quiet to the mind and listen. What's true? What can we start to believe is true in the body? Oh, this is what a breath feels like. And often folks who've had a lot of trauma, the breath, it's short, it's shallow, it stays up here. So being able to just notice that and not to change it, but as we can develop over sometimes years, a sense of ease in the body to be able to take deeper breaths, to feel the fullness of a breath, to involve the belly, the diaphragm, the lungs, that there can be a full range of a breath. Because in the dysregulated nervous system, the breath is short. It stays up here, right? Ready to go. All of this can be explored and we can become familiar with this terrain through these practices. Sometimes we very much need outside help to move through it. Trauma is definitely one of those neighborhoods. It's better to go in with a village than by ourselves. But the attention and familiarity that the practice can give us of, no, I know this sense. I know this feeling in my belly when something's not right. And we begin to trust ourselves. This is from Robert Hall. And I sat my first retreat with Robert decades ago. And the poem is, within the body you are wearing. Within the body you are wearing, now inside the bones and beating in the heart, lives the one you have been searching for so long. But you must stop running away and shake hands. The meeting doesn't happen without your presence, your participation. The same one waiting for you there is moving in the trees, glistening on the water, growing in the grasses and lurking in the shadows you create. You have nowhere to go. The marriage happened long ago. Behold your mate. Right? So beautiful. Behold this mate of ours that we are born with, we will die with. Been here all along. And how do we really, in some ways, sort of swim against the tide, swim against the stream? That saying, live anywhere but here. How to be able to embrace this body with its flaws, its aging, it's whatever, the ways it can be not in alignment with what we may be told the body should look like, and be like, oh my God, I can breathe. I can move in whatever way I can. Limits come. Okay. And we work within those limits. Yeah, to be like, okay, we're still here. And relating to this body of ours that will grow old and die, it will get sick. And not beat the body up for doing what it naturally will do. Yeah. From Jane Hirschfield, my skeleton. My skeleton, you who once ached with your own growing larger are now each year imperceptibly smaller, lighter, absorbed by your own concentration. When I danced. When you broke, I broke. And so it was lying down, walking, climbing the tiring stairs, your jaws, my bread. Someday you, what is left of you, will be flensed of this marriage. Angular wrist bones, arthritis, cracked harp of rib cage, blunt of heel, open bowl of the skull, twin platters of pelvis. Each of you will leave me behind at last, serene. What did I know of your days? your nights. I, who held you all my life inside my hands and thought they were empty. You, who held me all my life inside your hands as a new mother holds her own unblanketed child, not thinking at all. This friendship, right? This marriage. You who held me all my life inside your hands as a new mother holds her own unblanketed child, not thinking at all. That's quite a way to relate to these bones, this skeletal form of ours. Yeah. I've spoken before of the Venerable Analio's practice of, he has a skeleton in his practice room as a way of, as I've heard him speak of this, like, that's where we're going, right? The impermanence of this body will become that skeletal form. And James Hirschfield's sort of twist on that of, yes, the skeleton of ours holds us so dear as a mother holds an unblanketed child. That's quite a shift. And being able to drink in this idea, oh yeah, we are being held. You know, the hands holding each other. We're being held by the very skeletal form of this body of ours that is of the nature to grow old and die, of the nature to get sick, to bones break, to have allergies. Yeah, but we can slip into, I think, this disease of our culture to blame the body, get mad at the body for being a living organism that gets sick, gets hurt, has allergies. Yeah. I've shared this poem. I'm not going to go there yet. this is from Sri Nagasata Majarahi. I am that. There is only one mistake you are making. You take the inner for the outer and the outer for the inner. What is in you, you take to be outside you. And what is outside, you take to be in you. The mind and feelings are external, but you take them to be intimate. You believe the world to be objective, while it is entirely a projection of your psyche. That is the basic confusion. Yeah, I had to read this a number of times to really drop in with these teachings of how do we kind of right the ship of our own perceptions of a very subjective world that we live in. There's a book that I haven't quite finished, the name of which is escaping me, but it's about, written by a zoologist who talks about the different senses of all the animals. And there are certain birds and insects that see a whole dimension of color that we don't see. And it can't be described to us because we can't see it. And it can't be demonstrated to us because we can't see it. It's an infrared quality, but it's a whole nother realm of colors. And how dogs, for example, we all know dogs have incredible senses of smell and sound. And what was so interesting as I was listening to the book, I kind of assumed the world is the way it is. I see it. That's how everybody sees it. I've learned that's not quite so true. But the idea of other animals, other beings on this planet see a dramatically different world than we do helps support this notion of, oh, there's a lot of my own projection. The way I see the world is not necessarily how it is. It's how I see it, right? Because of the senses that I have, the qualities of my own sense of sound and sight and touch and taste, the sense doors, and also my own history, my conditioning, the environment I grew up in, all shapes, the subjective nature of the reality that I see. And being able to hold that of like, okay. One, can I then trust the senses here that there's, if the world, if I'm relating to it, understanding that it's subjective, it's helpful to be clear what's happening here in terms of when we're unaware, our capacity to project things all over the place is pretty great. And then the people that we're in relationship are with, stop doing that. You're not seeing me for who I am. We're seeing through this veil of projection. But the way we can take down that veil is to become very familiar with our own world, such that we're familiar with the reference point. Oh, right, this is me. This is my conditioning. this is my experience of a human. There's another, there's the a reality I experience, there's the absolute reality, and then each one of us has a different experience, right? This one's kind of long and I've shared it before, but I do love it. So I'm going to share it again. It's in John Rodel's book called, it's called Remedy. Number one. And bringing this in as like, how do we relate to the conversation that seems to always be happening in our body about what's true, what's not true, who's the reliable narrator in this inner committee of ours. And we have unreliable narrators. So it's important to, through this practice, be able to identify what the reliable narrators feel like when that voice comes on stage. Like, oh yeah, this is trustworthy. Yeah. My brain and heart divorced a decade ago over who was to blame about how big of a mess I have become. Eventually, they couldn't be in the same room with each other, and now my head and my heart share custody of me. I stay with my brain during the week, and my heart gets me on weekends. They never speak to one another. Instead, they give me the same note to pass to each other every week, and their notes they send to one another always say the same thing. This is your fault. On Sundays, my heart complains about how my head has let me down in the past. And on Wednesday, my head lists all of the times my heart has screwed things up for me in the future. They blame each other for the state of my life. There has been a lot of yelling and crying. So lately, I've been spending a lot of time with my gut, who serves as my unofficial therapist. Most nights, I sneak out of the window in my rib cage and slide down my spine and collapse on my gut's plush leather chair. That's always open for me. And I just sit until the sun comes up. Last evening, my gut asked me if I was having a hard time being caught between my heart and my head, and I nodded. I said I didn't know if I could live with either of them anymore. My heart is always sad about something that happened yesterday, while my head is always worried about something that may happen tomorrow, I lamented. My gut squeezed my hand. I just can't live with my mistakes of the past or my anxiety about the future, I sighed. And my gut smiled and said, in that case, you should go stay with your lungs for a while. I was confused. The look on my face gave it away. If you are exhausted about your heart's obsession with a fixed past, and your mind's focus on the uncertain future, your lungs are the perfect place for you. There is no yesterday in your lungs. There is no tomorrow there either. There is only now. There is only inhale. There is only exhale. There is only this moment. There is only breath. And in that breath, you can rest while your heart and head work their relationship out. This morning, while my brain was busy reading tea leaves and while my heart was staring at old photographs, I packed a little bag and walked to the door of my lungs. Before I could even knock, she opened the door with a smile. And as a gust of air embraced me, she said, "What took you so long?" And this movement, right, that we know between the different parts of ourselves that have opinions or focuses on worrying about the future, lamenting the past. The gut isn't always a source of wisdom. It can just be so tangled up and knotted and we have stomach aches. But this ability to sift through, oh, where are the reliable places to rest? Bear that in mind. I'm going to read one more on the same note. One of my favorite poems, Mary Oliver's Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of rain are moving across the landscape, over the prairies and deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. You do not have to be good. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. But in order to do that, you have to get pretty clear on what that small animal is, right? There can sometimes feel like there's a zoo inside. Yeah. So I asked you to close your eyes. And just to take a moment, connect with the body. There's a lot of words. Let yourself drop back into this body of yours. And to play a little, see how this goes. Who are the main conversationalists? You know, from Rodin's poem, the sort of warring factions, divorced factions of the mind and the heart, and the unofficial therapist of the gut and the welcoming arms of the lungs that just say, here, here, here. That may resonate for some, and others of us may have different party members, yeah, different folks, different aspects of ourselves that may be in contention. And just to play around to see if it's possible to identify the unreliable narrators, the part that might push us beyond our limits, the part that might tell us you're not good enough, or you can't do that, and you don't look right, too old, too young, not coordinated enough, not smart enough, you know, all that voice and the different expressions of I don't like this word, but it kind of fits a sort of the self-loathing, the ways that we can turn on ourselves. There's that voice. Some of you may not have it, some of us do. There's a part that can be so scared that maybe from those of us that had scary childhoods, that scared voice can still be here. Okay, that's here too. And to let yourself sort of switch image, there have been a number of them here, like the different parts of the body in conversation. You know, Mary Oliver is a small animal of the body, but it may take some dropping in to understand what's the voice of the small animal of the body. Image of the inner committee that we each have. Again, some reliable members, some really unreliable members. And the question is just sort of as you maybe fan out who these inner characters are, kind of playfully naming this. Can we feel into the voices that are unreliable? The harsh critic, the fear-based voice, the anxiety-based voice. Track that in the body. Yeah. When I'm in a place of anxiety, I can hear the voice, I can feel it in my body, or fear. Similarly, when we're in a place of congruence, when we're able to stand on what we know to be true about ourselves, our own Buddha nature, our own goodness, when we are embodied in that small animal of the body who knows what it loves, loves what it loves, that has a particular feeling, a particular quality. And this may land as true, this may land as what? Okay. But can we stay open to maybe not now, but later? Because much of our work through the practice is really being able to identify what's true, what's trustworthy. You know, the perfections of the heart, the paramis of integrity and generosity, truthfulness, patience, loving kindness, equanimity, wise use of energy, wisdom, those qualities can manifest as certain voices with a felt sense. Those are reliable places within us. And we are so much better equipped when we can identify when we're standing in those kind of shaky, fearful, anxious, self-critical voices. Like with a caution tape around, like, do not make decisions from here. Right? System is dysregulated. Okay, come back to the body. Feel the breath, feel the feet. Looking into the basket of tools that we explore together of how to re-regulate the system. Oh yeah, okay. There's a reliable place to move. There is a reliable, trustworthy, loving, open, Buddha-natured part of myself that is trustworthy. And so helpful to be able to have a known, felt sense of the unreliable and of the reliable. I found that does not happen necessarily overnight. So have us pause there. But to before we leave this space, to really let yourself lean into the imagined or the known reliable part, the part that is congruent with the goodness of the heart, that is in integrity and generous, patient at times. To feel into your own goodness, to have a felt sense of, oh yeah, this is the reliable part of me, the place that stands in my own truth. Know this feeling. It is a helpful and essential refuge. Thank you so much for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.